So if we're going to talk about creativity, these are the things that will help you thrive and stand apart, I guess, and in that kind of fully automated future.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin.
We are thrilled to have Jonathan Nelder on today's episode of the Fueling Creativity Podcast. For over 19 years, Jonathan has worked in education with a focus toward the integration of digital tools in learning environments. Jonathan is a globally awarded innovator in education, a futures learning coach at STEM Punks, an advanced Queensland digital champion, an Apple distinguished educator, and a CoSpaces ambassador, which named just a few on a very long list of amazing accomplishments. Jonathan, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Hey guys, thanks so much for inviting me on. Something about creativity, and that's where you had me. So yeah, it's great.
Okay, Jonathan, I've got the first question. We're going to launch straight into your work around future trends in education. So on your website, you mentioned that you spend about 90 minutes every day researching this area. So our question is, why are future trends important in education? And how does it serve your personal growth as an educator researching these trends?
Yeah, I mean, there's this fundamental, I think, idea. I think we all know it as educators that, you know, there's like whether it's a 10, 15 year kind of, you know, future time frame. So the kids, and in my case, it's often primary school, high school that I'm working with now, you know, what you're doing is meant to link, you know, to that future time zone, right? Like, it's great if they get some skills that can help them in the next couple of years or just help them get their assignments done better. But we're really, you know, ultimately that's what we're aiming for. I don't think we talk about that enough, actually, and making sure what we're doing now aligns with that. So yeah, that's always been a focus for me, I guess, is that thinking ahead. So introducing technology into the classroom, even when I was a learning difficulties teacher with struggling students, some, you know, things as basic as little digital voice recorders that they could, you know, that they could use to empower them so that rather than just relying on me to listen to their reading, they could play it back 3 times, 5 times if they needed to catch their errors themselves. So they're becoming more independent just with these cheap little, you know, digital voice recorders. And that was one of my early experiments, I guess, really opened my eyes up to, yeah, we've got to be really looking, you know, yeah, looking forward in that sense.
So when you look 10, 15 years into the future, what are some of the trends that you're seeing?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we could talk about the technologies, whether it's, you know, I think AR is going to just become more and more prevalent, you know, whether it's that we have glasses, et cetera. But, you know, yeah, so I mean, we could spend a whole bunch of time talking about that. But for me, that's getting excited about the tools and the tech, and that stuff will happen or it won't. Like, but where I'm sort of at after, yeah, that long in education and technology, et cetera, is that actually there's some more fundamental things that will, you know, that we should be focusing on. And all the research I did with the Future We community, that was sort of a two year, you know, fairly intensive deep dive into what are those technologies and the skills, etc. What really stood out from that is that's the human skills. So we talked a lot about future literacies. What are those literacies that you're going to need to really thrive? And the context is 4th Industrial Revolution. You know, much more automation than even that we have now. You know, robotics and what I like to call cobots, collaborative robot. You know, that kind of environment that becomes normal in that sort of time frame. And these future literacies is what you need. But what we really found was actually it's human, the human literacy. So if we're going to talk about creativity, you know, these are the things that will help you thrive and stand apart, I guess, and in that kind of fully automated future.
I do want to follow up on that because we had a really exciting episode with Brian Alexander in our first season. And I want to go back to that comment you made around cobots, because one of the things that we discussed, and to a certain extent, Cindy and I even focused in more on in our debrief episode for the season, was this idea of working in collaboration with machines and artificial intelligence. And so I think you're spot on with this idea that we have to be thinking about educating students for the future. And we can all say that, but to what extent do we do it? And I think the idea that we are going to be having to teach our students to think creatively in collaboration with artificial intelligence is an obvious example about what they most likely will be doing in the future workforce. So could you talk a little bit about what you're doing to try and prepare students for that future, particularly in regard to collaboration with AI?
So I mean, probably a really good example, the company I work with now, which is STEMpunks. So Australian founded company. Obviously we're doing STEM, but we also do a lot of design thinking as part of that. And we have a different approach, I guess. And it flows in from some of the work I was doing before as well. And so we're talking about cobots, you know, so like, you know, many STEM companies, we do cover coding, for instance, and electronics. But for a lot of people that, you know, and even in a lot of curriculums are written this way, that it's all about that tool. And if you teach coding, you're ticking all the boxes. Kids will be ready for the future because they can code, for instance. But we kind of know that's, you know, that's not true. You know, for instance, there's no code libraries now, and there's all, you know, AI coding that will, it's going to get to, you know, there was a time where we all had to learn HTML to build websites, but, you know, nobody does that anymore. And coding is, you know, you guys would understand this is very much the same. But instead of that, we want to talk about cobots, because if we're all going to be in an environment where we have assistants, whether they're software or actual hardware robots, etc., and of course there are a lot of professions where this is already the reality, it's much more an interesting problem to look at with students, this idea of, well, yeah, what are the skills we're going to need to get along with them and understand them, etc. And so if you're learning coding, it's really just that language that means you can understand them. You know, and if you're playing around, we use Microbit, BBC Microbit quite a lot. If you're understanding the electronics behind it, again, you've got that leg up because you know why it's not turning around properly, or, you know, you can understand, have that understanding of your cobot, your coworker, you know. It's so, you know, it's almost like you could relate that to empathy almost, or, you know, just, you know, you will be, and it makes sense, doesn't it? You'll be in a much, much, much better position. We get students to design a cobot, you know. We say, well, if you were in this kind of environment, you know, what would your cobot look like? And it might just be that we only have time for them to do a sketch. You know, we can discuss that and talk about and showcase a little bit. And then we go on to actually looking at the coding and the electronic side of things themselves. But that's, I mean, that's not hard to do right now today. And it just means that 10, 20 years in the future, when they're actually in that situation, it's not like, oh, this is the first I've ever heard of this. I need to collaborate with this robot. You know, we've sown those seeds much, much earlier.
And empathy, what a good skill to focus in on when you're talking about the human piece, because is there an argument to be said, at least at the moment, that empathy would be one of the human skills that we as people can bring to the table when working in collaboration with machines?
Yeah, very much so. And it comes really early in the project phase, you know. So, you know, you do a lot of design thinking with students now. And obviously the very first, you know, most iterations of design thinking have that exploring, empathizing, get to know your user at the very start. And it's something that it also with that the Future We community that we discovered from all that, the, you know, we had about 51, I think, different future literacies or skills that we boiled down and, you know, look for commonalities. And the very first ones were always around that exploring, just take time to stop, play around with, you know, ideas, etc. Get to know, you know, what's going on before you try and do anything else. Yeah.
So you did mention your work around STEMpunks. So I'd love to hear more about STEMpunks and how you believe STEM relates to creativity. Because when I speak with educators, they can't make that connection between STEM and creativity.
I guess we have an emphasis where we want to have STEM that is as spread as diversely as possible. So the appeal, whether you're talking about the lower numbers of females who, you know, generally enter STEM fields, or just, you know, diverse backgrounds. And we can all agree that the more diverse ideas and minds you have involved, the better everything will end up being at the end. So again, just that example of, rather than just going and let's teach coding, and, you know, there might be 10% of kids who are just naturally love coding or the idea of just that itself, right? But if you want a whole class, and this is often, you know, we rock up to a new school, we don't know these kids, if I just stood up there and said, hey, we're going to do coding, and I only have 10% who are kind of excited about that, you know, but if we're talking about, hey, what kind of collaborative robot are, you know, you're going to design and think about, et cetera, you have a much higher than 10%, I guess. So you're opening up to more of a problem-solving approach, I guess. And another example would be in a lot of the space-based workshops that I have a specific interest and bent for, is that, again, instead of going, oh, how are we going to solve radiation in space, you know, really hard science, you know, and there's a lot of good STEM stuff you can do out of that. And let's face it, most space-based learning programs will focus on those hard kind of problems. But instead, again, that would, you know, there'd be a certain small percentage that would naturally really want to get into that, and the rest are like, meh. But I guess what we do to flip that instead is go, okay, if humans are going to Mars, they're going to be away from Earth for 3-4 years minimum. So what kind of base are you going to design that will mean the humans are happy living away? And you can immediately see how that's a much more creative topic. Yeah, they could look at the radiation and how thick do the walls need to be, et cetera. But, you know, that's not off the table for, you know, for those kids. But, and we have kids, I'll tell you, if we've got time, I'll tell you a couple of my two favorite examples that kids have come up with in that scenario. And one was a rainbow. Okay. So this girl designed a rainbow. So she's talking about, you know, water resources, and you're spraying that into the air, and then you're having some lights and you're making a rainbow. And when she got up to present hers and everyone saw this rainbow, you can imagine that, you know, the more logical science mind looks at that and goes, why have you got a rainbow? That's just ridiculous, you know? But when she explained it to everyone from this really human, you know, creative perspective of, well, actually, she thought it was worthwhile spending that water resources, you know, and the energy, et cetera, because it's the only rainbow on Mars. Like, and everyone who's on that planet would travel for miles to come and see that and just feel, you know, and see something from Earth and from home. And then everyone went, oh, yeah, actually, that's, you know, that's really good. So having that theme of what do humans need to be happy living on Mars opens up that creativity, I guess, but still has room for all that STEM side of things. The other example was some boys who basically designed a version of soccer football that would work in Mars gravity, you know, because you've still got exercise and competition. They really thought that would keep humans, you know, healthy and happier. You know, so they had to work out. I think they made it like only 5-a-side, and yeah, you know, all that sort of stuff. Just yeah. So for me, that's a real melding of the creativity with, you know, still looking at the STEM, for instance, the gravity, etc. So yeah, there's a couple of examples.
Our next question actually introduces a very renowned creativity scholar, E. Paul Torrance, who I believe wrote a book called Save Tomorrow for Our Children, which is where he had different children try and predict the future, because one of the creativity skills that he identified was our ability to get glimpses of the future. And so I'm wondering if, you know, maybe talking about your work with Future We or at STEMpunks, if you could expand a little bit on the type of strategies that you bring into these project-based learning environments that help cultivate that particular skill set in terms of getting students to think in the way you're getting them to think about what will the human piece, the human problems of these future situations do we need to consider?
Firstly, it is really just taking the time and setting aside that time for that, whether it's design thinking, it's that first know your user exploring kind of phase. And in the Future We framework, you know, that was also called Explore. And that was that time where you actually make it okay to not do any other planning or, you know, anything else, but just play and explore that space. So when I do face-to-face workshops, for instance, I have a drama teacher background. So we'll do some, you know, some kind of role play activities. So, you know, one of the best strategies I found was actually have something physical. And this sort of the idea of props, I guess. You know, so for the space workshops, gone out of my way to actually get some metal that's been in space, for instance, and it costs about $30-$40 to be able to pass that around and students physically hold that. And I would pass it around. It's a little medallion from the shuttle, one of the shuttle missions. And, you know, they think it's cool. You pass it around, et cetera. So that idea of the physical, I guess, is really, really good. Mystery is the second one because I don't actually tell them that it's got metal that's been in space. They start off just thinking it's a cool medallion. And after everybody's touched it, et cetera, Then I tell them, okay, you've just touched something that's actually been in space. And you get that little moment of, And so by taking the time to do those kind of activities, whether it's them holding something physical, et cetera, by the time you actually get to more the harder planning and designing, they're just so much more into it. They're in that space. Unfortunately, you know, with schools, probably the same with, you know, university, you don't have a lot of time. You know, you've got to get to what's in the assignment. What do I need to do for the assignment? And so generally we skip that part. You know, most of education that I was a part of, there's just not time for that. And yet if you can invest in that, as I said, by the time you get to the actual, okay, what are we, what are, you know, what's the work part? The results are just always so much deeper, and you'll get ideas like, you know, a rainbow on a Mars base, et cetera, because they've taken that time to immerse themselves in that space. Yeah, so there's a couple of things that, that really help if you can take that time.
Jonathan, can you tell us more about your program, First School on Mars, and where it came from and how it's grown?
Yeah, for sure. I guess I had a period which you could call it a couple of different things. You could call it, like a 6-month sabbatical, or you could call it a forced leave from the job that I was in at the time. But it was still this interesting sort of 6-month period where, you know, I'm mid-career, fairly experienced, et cetera. And I had the time to actually sit back and look at some of these bigger picture questions, which is where Future We came out of. And I got to design if I was going to put together what I thought was the best, I guess, workshop experience to give kids those future skills, what would it look like? And that's where, the first Kids on Mars came from. And part of the original idea came from a former friend at the New Media Consortium, actually, NMC, when it was around. And we'd sort of met up. She was in Brisbane one time and had this idea of the first school on Mars. So what would the first school on Mars need to look like? And we have actually used that concept with teacher professional development just to get you out of your everyday and just really give you that space to think differently. And then the student version of that became the first Kids on Mars, and this really interactive workshop with the space objects and, you know, the role playing, and then the students, you know, designing their own bases, etc. So yeah, that was kind of the journey into it. And it was really that rare chance for me to bring all the, you know, my greatest hits, I guess, from, as I said, drama teaching, the technology, you know, those various things, as well as that those creative elements, like, together. So yeah, that's kind of the backstory. And then continuing that and, you know, evolving it. Now I'm working with STEMpunks as well. So we're now able to do a similar thing, but online. You know, it's not quite the same, but it means that students in a much broader, you know, all around the world even can have that experience as well.
So, Jonathan, as an education technologist, what do you consider as good practices when using digital tools to cultivate creative thinking in the classroom? Because we've got a whole bunch of technology. You keep calling them tools. And I think I agree with you, they're tools. So what's the best practices for individuals using these tools?
Yeah, so it's really, you know, I'm coming back to this idea of mindset again before you even touch any tools themselves. And, you know, I have to admit it took me many years actually to figure this out properly and be able to do it first. And by first, I mean talking about your priorities, your goals. What are you trying to, what are you actually trying to achieve with your students, rather than, oh, I've got this new shiny thing. how am I going to use it? And yeah, I made a lot of mistakes, you know, in talking just about the shiny things. How do you turn it on, et cetera, and then sitting back and expecting teachers to do amazing things with it. It wasn't until I realized, no, again, that was like that 10% of teachers who were into tech themselves will jump in it, and the rest will be like, yeah. But it took me a while to, and I had some really great mentors to come around to the approach instead, to start with, okay, what, you know, it's pretty simple really, but what are our learning goals? What are we trying to achieve with students? And let's have that conversation first of all. You know, so for instance, at the school I was at the time, we really wanted students to be more independent learners, be able to teach themselves a bit, take on that more of that responsibility. And that's a goal that every teacher in the school can get behind. It's going to make their lives easier, you know, benefit the students, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the conversation about, oh, well, what technology might, what tools might help us do that, for instance. And, you know, things like, you know, what I call personal learning devices, which could be laptops or iPads or whatever, are hugely powerful tools that students can then use to find their own podcasts and resources and keep track of their learning and et cetera, et cetera. And they're pretty common, those devices, in schools nowadays, obviously. But that's, you know, that should be why we're getting these devices. Well, it's because, yeah, students can use them to be more independent learners, for instance. So working, whatever that goal is first, is what you work that out first. And then you can go, oh, well, this tool will do that, or this tool will do that, et cetera. So that kind of change in approach from, you know, oh, my admin's just bought 100 iPads. Okay. I guess we better try and use them somehow. But again, it's about taking that time to have that conversation in the first place. You know, what are our learning goals really? What are we all actually trying to achieve and pull together on? And oftentimes, too busy to have that conversation properly. It's much easier to look at, oh, look at that university or that school. They're doing really well. Let's just buy whatever they bought. Let's just try and copy them, again, without having had that proper conversation yourselves. So, yeah, there's some thoughts on that.
I'm really curious, Jonathan, how things are in Australia and particularly attitudes toward creativity in Australia. So when you go in to work with schools, you get a lot of resistance. Are people open to it? Where do you find the challenges there?
I'd imagine it's pretty similar to what I've seen when I've been over in the US and other places. It's a mix. You know, there'll be some schools where they already have that really open mindset. And I think it goes hand in hand with student agency. If you're willing to give students a bit more agency and independence, et cetera, then that kind of links in with that, you know, there's more room for that creativity and that exploring. So there are schools we go into where it's very much they've almost asked us to come and work with them because they're already across that and want more of that. There are other schools you go to where you know that they're just ticking boxes. But in those schools, sometimes that's almost my favorite schools to go to, though, because the students in those schools are the ones that, you know, we might be the only ones that year that come in and say, hey, let's design something. What do you think? And that little spark is, you know, it's one of those things that why you're an educator, I guess. So there's, yeah, it's very much a mix. Cindy, as I said, there's some schools who really get that future focus on why that exploring is needed. But, you know, there's a range of reasons why other schools aren't there. As I said, you know, busy, lots of stresses, et cetera, you know.
I think you've already answered this, but I'm just curious, when we have a new piece of technology in the classroom, to what extent is the technology fueling the new ideas when it comes to creativity? Or to your point, are the new ideas already in place and are they shaping how the technology is being perceived and used in the classroom?
Yeah, I guess in my experience, there's probably two phases, you know, around introducing new technologies. And what I was saying just before about no. Do your learning goals and do that first and then later choose the technology. That's what I would say, recommend for probably, you know, the 90%, you know, schools and educators and, you know, educational institutions. If no, you know, if you didn't also have the 10% who are doing that, ooh, new shiny thing, let's get some digital voice recorders with kids who are, having difficulties learning to read and let's just try this and, you know, see what. So it's a bit of a mix of both, I guess, in a way. There are that smaller percentage where you need people at that top end who are trying it and this works or this doesn't work. And partly that's because no one really builds education technology. Mostly it's consumer products or business products that we're trying to adapt. So you've got to have those people who are doing that, whether their admin are okay with it or not or whatever. You know, you guys are probably this yourself and you know people who are going to try these things out. And then that will eventually, the things that work, you know, hopefully start to filter through to everybody else. So that when everybody else is had that conversation about learning goals, et cetera, then they know what tools, you know, to then pick from, I guess, if that makes sense.
Well, we end every episode with three tips that we would ask you to give educators to help them bring creativity into their classrooms. So do you have three tips for us today that you can share?
It might be more of a recap, Cindy. So the idea of bringing physical props into the classroom. And even if we take a step back, if I make number one, this idea of just making time for exploring first. Make time for that. And that can often mean giving the students that agency to find things, et cetera, and then share it back with everybody else. Let's make this number two as part of that is this idea of actual physical things. And it might be as simple as we're studying topic X. I'm going to find some 3D files and print them. And then kids have got a physical, you know, I've done this with Mars craters, for instance. You know, so there's nothing like a kid actually just putting their finger and tracing the outlines of an actual crater where, you know, curiosity or perseverance are going around on Mars. It's just that extra, you know, connection from those physical. And oftentimes you can find something on eBay or, you know, something that's physical, et cetera.
What about some recommendations in terms of people to follow or websites to follow to stay up on the trends that are happening?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I can definitely recommend our futurewe.org website. So you'll be able to access the framework there that starts with that exploring phase and then actually goes through five different phases. There's some links on there for a survey you can take with yourself, your colleagues, or your students. It's more of a discussion starter, I guess, like where are you actually up to against these five phases in terms of being, you know, future ready? Yeah, so that's a really good one. I always love people, obviously, to visit the stempunks.com website. And even just looking at the classes, maybe the student classes that we're doing, would give you that sense of, oh, okay, yeah, they're not just teaching straight coding, but what are those, the sort of the problem that you can start from instead? And I'll obviously be recommending your podcast now the next time someone asks me that as well.
Well, Jonathan, our time is up, but we greatly appreciate you meeting with us today on the Fueling Creativity podcast. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This show was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with TeachersInnovationStudio.com.
On our next episode of the Fueling Creativity podcast, Cindy and myself engage in our first debrief of season 2. But until then, please continue to keep fueling the conversation using the hashtag #FuelingCreativity.